Hey, super fans. This is Richard Donner.
Hello, everyone. This is Julian Glover.
Hi, everyone. This is Katrina Law.
This is Michael Uslan, the executive producer of the Batman movies.
Hey, guys. This is Brett Dalton. I play Grant Ward in Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Hello, all you truckers out there. This is Nichelle Nichols.
Hey there, comic book fans. This is Arlene Sorkin, the original Harley Quinn from the DC Animated Universe.
Hey, all you Trekkers and Trekkies and pop culture fans, this is John Delancey, coming to you from the Q Continuum.
Hi there, pop culture fans, this is Steven D'Souza.
Hey, super fans, this is Dana Delaney, Lois Lane from the DC Animated Universe.
Hey, Bat fans, this is Burt Ward, Robin from the original Batman TV series, and you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. Holy preeminent podcast!
Hey, comic book fans, this is Mark Hamill. You're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Hi there, comic book and sci-fi fans. This is Bill Mumy, and you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. And that's a good thing. That's a real good thing.
Hello to all you fans of geek, nerd, and pop culture, science fiction, fantasy, superheroes, comic books, everything awesome. Welcome to each and every member of Comic Book Central Nation. This is Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. I'm your host, Joe Stuber. You are in the lair right where you need to be. This is the place. This is episode 200, the Comic Book Central 4th anniversary special. My look back at year 4 of the show, and what a year it was. I promised you bigger and better for this year. I hope I delivered. I think I did. The guests on the show, man, each and every year, they're amazing. But this past year, man, do we have the stars hanging out with us here in the lair. This is where those folks who bring comic books to life hang out. This is where the cool kids hang out. And I could not do this show without each and every one of you listeners out there. You are out there downloading, you're streaming the show, you're sharing the lair each and every week with your friends and family. You send in some of your favorite moments from the past year. I'm going to revisit those today as well. And for two of you listeners out there, you are going to score some sweet stuff. That's right. It's my anniversary, but you get the gift. I do this every year. Arrow Season 3 on Blu-ray, that stunning Mark Hamill Trickster sketch cover signed by artist Lynn Workman, inspired by my February guest, Mr. Mark Hamill. Those two items, they're going out. I'm going to tell you later who gets them. And I'm telling you what, I really, really want to hang on to that Trickster sketch cover. It is a thing of beauty. I got it right here. I'm looking right at it. It's Flash issue number 39 with a wraparound sketch cover. Lynn's work is nothing short of spectacular, but I can't keep it as much as I want to hang on to it. I can't. I promised one of you out there is going to get it. So I'm sending it out and you're going to love it when you get it. Trust me. By the way, I just saw on Facebook, Lynn's family mentioned that his recent surgery went well. So glad to see that. Lynn, speedy recovery. Get those Flash-like healing powers in effect. Take the time you need to get back to good health, but we want to see you back at that drawing board, healthy. So glad everything went well. We want you bringing us those characters that we know and love. Your artwork is incredible. Get better soon. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for your generous giveaway this year. That was fantastic. Some listener is going to be really, really happy to get this. So, hey, you can keep up with Lynn, see how he's doing on social media. And his blog, Have Geek Will Travel, he's posting stuff on there whenever his family's posting stuff on Facebook right now. I'm sure when he's back up to speed, he's going to be making some posts as well. I'm going to put the links up in the show notes for this episode at my website, comicbookcentral.net. So again, speedy recovery, Lynn, and thank you so much for that giveaway. All right, little reflection time here in the lair. Launched the show back on November 8th, 2013. So if you're new to the show, you might want to go back and check out that episode. Great place to start if you're new to the show. I started off the podcast chatting with none other than Stan the Man Lee. Great conversation there. Since the show premiered, I have welcomed 235 guests. The show's been downloaded in 159 countries. I can't believe that. Thank you so much, everybody out there that's downloading the show. Thanks to all of you out there for listening. Comic Book Central Nation continues to grow bigger and better each year. You're checking out the episodes each week at the website, comicbookcentral.net. You're subscribing to the show on iTunes. You're leaving reviews. I love when you do that. You're listening on Blueberry, Stitcher, Google Play. You're downloading it. You're sharing the episodes on social media. I appreciate that as well. Facebook.com/Comic Book Central Network. Twitter at ComicBookCTRL. There's links to both of those on the website, ComicBookCentral.net. Again, if you're new to the show, welcome. So glad to have you on board. This is a great starting point. You get to sample a little bit of what's happened over the past year. And good news, you got 199 episodes out there waiting for you. So plenty out there to listen to. So glad to have you all on board. Year four, it was epic. Let's take a look back at the year that was, shall we? And one of the guests I welcomed to the lair was one who joined me early on in the show's run. Producer Michael Uslan, he made a return trip to Comic Book Central. Back in year one, we talked all about Batman. That was the 1989 movie he produced. He got us The Dark Knight. He got us that finally. And Michael promised to return to talk about Swamp Thing, his 1982 film. Pulp Heroes as well. We wanted to talk about Pulp Heroes. So we didn't get a lot of chance to talk on the first episode about Swamp Thing and Pulp Heroes, but he promised he would return. Michael has written numerous comic book tales about Pulp Heroes. So I asked him about the challenges of bringing those characters from the pages to movies and television. Okay, Pulp Heroes. I want to get to this. We talked about the comic book properties that you're writing. You love you some Pulp Heroes. I mean, going back to the serials, the original pulp, not all these things, correct? I mean, you are a historian about this.
I do. Yeah.
Okay. In translating these to live action, they work so well in the comic books. I think Dynamite, I mean, pun intended, is doing a Dynamite job with the Lone Ranger. I thought that was unbelievable. Your series, Justice Inc., featuring The Shadow, Doc Savage, The Avenger, amazing. And you're going back and you're setting these things in very cool time periods, 1936, 1939, all these little references. I love the, by the way, the historical footnotes by Michael Uslan, or footnotes
well,
to history.
I'm a history major and I'm a history buff. And this gives me an opportunity to combine my greatest loves in life into one kind of writing and writing alternative history with these pulp characters or with Batman, like I did on the graphic novel Detective Number 27, is just pure joy to me.
But so many of these are difficult to bring to the big screen. Why do you think these pulp heroes are so challenged in adapting them for live action?
I think there's a couple of things at play here. One of which is in the world in which we live today. It is a world that of younger audiences that are devoted to armor and spandex and leather. And the cloth and the fedora and the trench coat no longer seem to have the universal appeal. And unless you attempt it in a way that can make it fresh and intriguing to this younger generation, you are going to have a problem. Now, perfect example of how I think that worked well was La La Land. And by that I mean you had generations now of young people that have spurned the whole concept of the American movie musical. And through La La Land, they found an innovative way to reach young people, make it accessible and interesting for them, that brings back really the chance to do movie musicals again. And the old timers who saw it, if I may, loved it and recognized that, oh my God, it is a musical, and the younger people are attracted to it. That's kind of what needs to be done in terms of approaching pulp characters in the media. Now, let me go back a number of years. I thought the Phantom movie was terrific, actually. I thought it had a great story. It was well acted. It was well directed. And I want to say my son was maybe 12 years old at the time it came out. So I said to him, all right, let's round up all your friends. I'm taking all of you to the movies on Saturday. I'll take you all to see the Phantom. And they said no. I go, wait a minute. When do 12-year-old boys say no to going to a movie for free? They thought it was so silly to see a guy in purple leotards from the commercials and the trailers running around the jungle It just didn't make any sense to them. It just seems silly. And you also have to understand that in the era of the pulps, there's a lot of aspects to them that have to be changed historically. You can't send a white guy over to Africa to save all the black people. It's ridiculous. It doesn't work. It taken out of that historical era where the adventures were initially set and bringing it into modern times. So you've got different sensibilities that you have to deal with in the course of it as well. And as you begin to move these all into the same mix, it becomes incredibly challenging. Hmm. Plus, regarding that, I've had a fight for decades, the mentality generally in Hollywood at the studio level of people telling me left and right, oh, you can't do period pieces don't sell. And I had one incident with a very famous director where he and I were in there working on a particular character that was a pulp character set in the 30s or 40s. And they said, now, and this guy who was probably 26 or 27 years old is telling us, no, period pieces don't sell. I go, yeah, well, what about Titanic? He says, well, that's different. I said, why is that different? He says, because that's history. I said, okay, what about Indiana Jones? And he goes, well, that's different. I go, why is that different? And he's thinking, he goes, well, maybe it's not different. I said, do you have research about this? Facts and figures, or is this just something you've heard regurgitated in the halls of this studio? And he goes, well, everyone knows it. I said, do you have any facts or any research? And of course he did not. It was some time later that the first Captain America movie came out and did it exceedingly well opening weekend. And I called him. I said, so what about Captain America? And I hung up the phone. He knew what I was talking about.
Yeah, in that conversation, we even got to chat a little bit about Doc Savage, a little bit of information about Doc Savage, you could tell us. Shazam, talked a little bit about that. He couldn't say a whole lot, obviously, about those projects, but I did throw those questions out there. Good stuff with Michael Uslan. Oh, really in-depth conversation, a lot of talk, a lot of topics that we covered there. I'm sure we're going to be chatting some more on a future episode. There's always so much to talk about with comic books when Michael's around. All right, took the show on the road a few times this year as well. Couple of Mystery Science Theater 3000 shows here in Columbus, Ohio. We're going to be talking about those in a little bit. A little bit further away from Columbus, the Cincinnati Comic Expo. Moderated a few Q&As there. I brought a couple of those to you here on Comic Book Central. And I got to meet legendary actor Julian Glover at the Cincinnati Comic Expo. Now, Julian, you remember from The Empire Strikes Back, For Your Eyes Only, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, more recently Game of Thrones. I got to chat with him prior to the expo, and we talked about his approach to playing villains. He played some great villains in those films. We even got to talk a little bit about a nice surprise that happened during casting for Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
When you play a baddie, you've got to work out why he's the baddie. He is, after all, a human being. And I remember being in a film with Alec Guinness when he played Hitler the Last 10 Days, it was called. And he made a very reasonable person out of Hitler. He made him into a human being. We all knew what he really was, but he made him into a human being. And when you play a baddie, you've got to think, why is he like this? And what is his motive for doing this? And although it may be a base motive in other people's eyes, it's one which he wishes to achieve and will do all sorts of things to achieve it. And so it wasn't difficult to be the person that Walter Donovan was, which was a very charming, very successful businessman with a tremendous interest in archaeology and history, who was a studied and an intellectual man, had a beautiful wife and a very lovely apartment in New York. It wasn't difficult to be that and carry on being it until he was discovered as being horrible. But then he didn't stop being what he was. He was still the same guy. It just you knew that he was a naughty person. However, I have to say to you, as I've said to many people before, what would you or any of your readers or listeners do for the secret of eternal life? Yeah. That's what he was after, and I challenge anyone to deny that they would go a very long way in order to get that.
He even makes that point in the film. I mean, he says, well, as soon as Hitler goes the way of the dodo, I'm still going to be
right.
drinking. Yeah,
that's right.
That's an amazing point. You mentioned, I got to ask you about Walter Donovan's lovely wife.
Yes. Well, as you know, it was my wife.
Yes, I do. Yeah.
Well, that came about because I'd started doing it. Well, no, I hadn't started doing it yet. And I read the first scene, which she's in. And I said, you could play that. She said, oh, I'd love to be on the set just with Harrison Ford. What a lovely, glamorous thing to do. And I mentioned it in passing. Ida said it would be a wonderful idea, but only in a sort of a passing, not suggesting she did it. And they did it. They cast her. And she was never so terrified in her life. And she's worked with Richard Harris, for God's sake. She knows what fear on stage is. And it was her most terrifying day. She came on and looked absolutely glorious. You know about the billing on that film, of course.
She's billed as, yeah.
you know about the billing, the credits at the end.
Tell my listeners in case they're not familiar with it.
Okay. At the end, she was quite well-known actress over here, and Ida Blair, yes, she was quite well-known. And so she said, I don't really want to be known for doing this. It was lovely to do it. So they worked out a scheme, which when the credits came up, it was Walter Donovan, played by Julian Glover, Mrs. Donovan, played by Mrs. Glover.
Love that.
And that's still there.
I love
seeing
it. I'm
going to say not a lot of people know that, but they do now.
All right, another time I got to take the show on the road was Terrificon. I've been there the past few years, always have an amazing time at Terrificon in Connecticut. I brought you a few episodes from there as well, my Q&As. Now, summer 2016, the previous year's Terrificon, I got to meet Arrow's Katrina Law. Then she joined me on the show a few months later for an in-depth chat and talked about how much fun she has meeting the fans at these conventions. Well, last time I saw you was this past summer at Terrificon in Connecticut. And then a few minutes later, you're dancing with a Hulkbuster.
It's what you do at a convention, you know what I mean? It's on the day's work.
You have a blast at these conventions, don't you?
You know, I love going to conventions. It's such a great way to be able to see the fans in person and say thank you for supporting me, and then also give them a chance to talk about some of their favorite characters and getting to interact with them and just being on a basic human level with people and being able to say hi and thank you is wonderful. And then cosplay is one of my favorite things about the conventions. I love when people dress up. So when the Hulkbuster was over there, I just about geeked out of my mind. So it was great to be able to dance with him. And he was so coordinated.
I don't know how he did. He was like going up and down and shaking hands with like some of the comics creators. And I don't know how, look, if you haven't seen it, go on YouTube. It's out there, but this thing is mad. It's a life-sized Hulkbuster. I don't know how they did
it.
Yeah,
and he had some dance moves, too. I was actually surprised he wasn't wiping out small children.
It was pretty close. There was like a little Wolverine there that came pretty close, but it was not too bad.
Yeah, I think he was confused by everything that was happening.
I think so, too, yeah. Because you go to these conventions, and there's always like there's one level of celebrity where they kind of like never leave their table, never look up, you know, rarely look up from their tables. And then there's the opposite end of the spectrum, which is you. Because you are just like going like seven ways to Sunday.
Well, I figure, you know what? It's a good time for everyone, and I'm going to enjoy myself while I'm there. I don't know when the next time is I'll be able to say thank you to people and get to interact with the crazy cosplayers. So I'm going to take advantage while I can.
All right, we recorded our interview as her new series, Training Day, was set to premiere. It starred Bill Paxton, who unfortunately passed away just about a month and a half after the interview with Katrina. But when we were chatting, she was talking about working with him, what an incredibly nice man he was, and how he would actually say his catchphrase from Aliens when the cast and crew would prompt him. So just a really great guy. Now, over the summer, so months later, I got to chat with another of Bill Paxton's castmates, this time Brett Dalton from Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And this was Bill Paxton had passed away. So Brett talked about his memories of working with Bill on the show, as well as the great Powers Booth, who we also lost this past year. Man, this year, we recently lost two powerhouse actors. Hated to see us. You mentioned him, Bill Paxton, back in February. Powers Booth, back in May.
Yeah.
You got a chance to work with both of them. Can you give us some insight into your experiences working with both and maybe what you learned from them, not either from an acting perspective or just in a life perspective?
I mean, it's heavy. It's heavy.
Yeah, it was.
Both of these, two have lost both of them, and both of them were co-stars that I got to work with, not just on screen, but also off screen. I think more than all of the acting stuff, because that's just little tricks and techniques and things. More than anything, I learned from both of them the importance of having a life outside of this work and how important family is and how that's the real work. This other stuff is temporary and it's fun and it's great and it's exciting and it's fulfilling. But the thing that's really fulfilling is having a life and a family and taking care of those as priorities as well. And that's what I learned more than anything else. Every time I brought my daughter to set, my wife Powers was there playing with my kid and just reminding me every other time that you got such a beautiful family, man. That's what's most important. And the same with Bill. I mean, he would remember the last conversation he had with my wife. When my parents came to visit, he was, God, I still remember the scene that we were doing. I was pretending to have him as a hostage. It was on this, on the rooftop of this thing. And there was a, I was trying to gain access into this building. Anyway, he's like handcuffed with his hands behind his back. And we're shooting this intense scene, big green screen scene. And my parents came on. He's like, "Oh man, these are your parents." And he came over and he still had his hands, you know, behind his back all set. But he was shaking their hands even like that.
Like from behind, pulling his hands out.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. He didn't need to do that. He could have just said, "Hey, what's up? Oh, I'm working," or whatever. And that would have been just fine. Oh, but he made a point to like stop whatever was happening. Come on over, meet my family, my parents and my brother. And everybody, I mean, he makes the best impression because he's just genuinely one of the best, most generous people I have ever met. And even, you know, he would email me in 48 hours every time I got back to him. And I was like, every time, like, he's Bill Paxton, man. He doesn't need to get back to me. Certainly not this quickly. Like, God. But that's what was important to him. Connections with other people.
Both actors truly missed. Man, we talk about tributes to those we've lost this past year. Another big loss this year, our beloved Batman, Adam West, who passed away in June at the age of 88. I was set to interview both Adam and Burt Ward. They were going to be at Terrificon for what would have been their final Connecticut appearance. Adam unfortunately passed away before I got a chance to record an in-depth chat with him. But as it turns out, boy, that weekend at Terrificon, that became a three-day tribute to the legendary actor. If you've seen the pictures I posted from there on the Facebook page, you can get a sense of that tribute that was taking place there. One of the great moments of that weekend, watching Batman the movie, Burt Ward and Lee Merriweather were in attendance in the theater. That was a moment. Oh, boy, that was such an amazing weekend. Now, I did get a chance to record an interview with Burt Ward, TV's original Robin to Adam's Batman. Again, leading up to the show, got a chance to chat with him. Burt Ward, Adam West, they got to appear in one more film this year, Batman vs. Two-Face. Go get it on Blu-ray. It's awesome. You're going to love it. The chance to hear those two as Batman and Robin again. Oh, so glad we got that movie. I spoke to Burt about his memories of Adam, working with him on the series, and touring the world, meeting all of their Bat fans. Hey, before we get to the Bat chat, and we've got a lot to talk about, I do want to mention Man, on behalf of my listeners, sincere condolences on the recent loss of Adam West. My goodness, our bright night. That was tough to take.
Yes, Adam and I were friends for more than 50 years. We met about 10 minutes before our screen test in July of 1965. And in 5 minutes, the two of us were laughing, and we never stopped laughing for more than 50 years later. And the two of us together, we saw the humor in this, and we played it very straight for the kids. We always, always played it straight for the kids so that there would be true, you know, the hero worship and the idea of riding in the Batmobile and fighting villains and climbing walls. And yet for the adults, there was the nostalgia of the comic book. And for the teenagers and the college kids, which at that time was almost an impossible audience to capture, it was the double meanings and the insinuations. Nobody had ever played with their TV audience. Nobody had ever done that. And we taunted and teased and misled and did, and people loved it.
You guys hit on a lot of levels. You guys hit it on a lot of levels. I think it was so underrated at the time. Look, we're still talking about 50 years later, so you did something right back in the day, that's for sure. You talked about the closeness, the bond between you and Adam West, too. I'm telling you, the two of you have been touring quite a bit over the past few years, especially since the 50th anniversary and all these different things. What was Adam like on the road when you guys would just like hit the road? The adventures the misadventures of Adam and Bert. I think it was a movie at one time, but
well, that TV movie of the week was based on both of our books.
Yeah.
And the one thing I'll tell you about Adam that surprised
yours was a little different than Adam's, though.
I told more of the story. You see, he told his viewpoint, and you know, Adam, you know, when he was so wonderful. I mean, the way he approached his role of Batman, he kind of thought of himself in very grand terms. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, he used to say there were three B's, you know, Bond, Beatles, and Batman. And, you know, he envisioned himself kind of like, you know, some great international political leader, you know, like Winston Churchill. In fact, one time he said to me that he really understood how important it was to play Batman when he watched Charlton Heston play Moses and part the Red Sea.
Look, I'm not going to argue with that. That's, again, we're still talking about it 50 years later.
Exactly. And for me, I was just the exact opposite. I'm like a kid that never grew up, never will grow up, talk fast. And none of this grandiose, you know, I mean, I just see right through it. And to me, it's a, you know, and so the exciting thing to know about Adam that your listeners will obviously probably not know is that everything that you saw of him on television and in the movies, everything, the style, all of that was exactly like he is in real life. There's no difference. None. Zero. I love meeting the fans. They have a great time. And, you know, at these appearances, not only do I sign autographs, okay, and not only do we have photo ops where they have their picture taken, but in addition to that, we have these things called panels where we speak to a group and can be anywhere from, I would say, a minimum of 500 to 5,000 attendees, and they get a big area, a big room, and Adam and I would speak for anywhere from 45 minutes to an hour, answer questions. I'm going to be doing that. But what I was going to say is that there's something ironic I want to share with you. And when Adam and I would do these panels together, and this is literally just a couple months ago we did the last one, that I would be introduced first and I talk briefly, and then Adam would be introduced and he'd come out and everybody's cheering and everything. And when the cheering would die down, Adam would say to the audience, he'd say, "Ladies and gentlemen, I'm just going to stand here a few extra moments and allow you to gaze at my incredible physical development." And of course, people are laughing. And he'd say, "Would you like to know how at 88 years of age that I stay in such good shape?" And, you know, nobody knows, obviously. And he says, "Because every morning I have a bowl of Burt Ward's Gentle Giant dog food." And people are crying. There are tears in their eyes. They're laughing so hard.
That's good stuff.
But here's the irony. I got to tell you, Joe, here's the irony. The irony is that This is real. My wife and I really have doubled and tripled the lifespan of dogs, but I haven't been able to do it for humans because if I could, Joe, I would give anything to have doubled the lifespan of my dear friend and have him here for another 88 years.
Yeah, we all wish that as well, Bert. But we do have the TV series. We've got the movies. We've got the new animated movies. Bert is still touring. Sometimes he's with Lee Merriweather. There's Batmobiles. There's all kinds of bat stuff going on. He is keeping the bat signal burning. If Bert Ward is anywhere near you at a convention, go see him and relive Batmania all over again. It's so much fun to chat with him. All right, time for a listener email. I asked you what your favorite moments from the past year were. Okay, heard from several of you out there. First up, I heard from Jeff Messer, who writes, "What an incredible year. It is nearly impossible to pick just one favorite moment. I could go into how I was transported back to my childhood and shown a peek behind the curtain with Donald Kaysen and the power records of my youth, or I could go up, up and away over Richard Donner. There was also a pretty marvelous Mark Hamill episode. I felt the warm and fuzzies over Julian Glover, whom I saw on stage in London in 1993. And then I felt sad hearing him confuse details of Indiana Jones and Star Wars. But he's allowed after the career and life he's had. And the Alexander Siddig interview was a pure joy to listen to. What a guy. But I have to say that I geeked out the most listening to Stephen D'Souza recount his career and adventures. Kudos to another stellar year." Hey, thanks, Jeff. Thanks so much for writing in. A lot of great moments you mentioned there. There's a bunch there. But let's revisit one with Stephen D'Souza, where we talked about his time in the world of the Bionic Duo. You got to wrap up the Bionic Woman.
I did wrap the Bionic Woman, but then they ended up shooting an added scene because they're going to go into syndication, where even though I ended the series, like full stop.
Okay, tell our listeners how, for those that haven't seen the episode yet, it's called On the Run. It's a series finale. Our listeners how it ends, but how your script ended.
Well, what happened was the opening was she rescues like a girl from communists, kidnappers. She's going.
There's a theme that's going on.
Well, it was the go-to villains, you know. She's guarding an ambassador's daughter. This is one of my local jokes. One of the things we used to do on those shows is we used to have to invent countries because, like, I would write a script and I'd say, like, the ambassador of Czechoslovakia is actually a communist agent.
Yeah.
They say, you can't do that. We'll get sued by, like, the ambassador from Czechoslovakia. So we made up fake countries. So, like, I made up one country for an episode called Lithuania. Sounds like a real Eastern Bloc country, Lithuania. And I invented Valverde, which I've used ever since, by the way. But I first invented it for the Bionic Woman or something. And then my favorite one was on this show. There's a neighborhood called Toluca Lake, which is in the valley, right near the studios. Bob Hope was the most famous resident. There's really a lake there, a rare thing in, you know, Southern California. So there was an apartment building, which was a nice-looking apartment building called the Toluca Embassy. So I said, we got to film this in front of this so I can make up a country called Toluca. So anyway, Lindsay Wagner is guarding the daughter of the ambassador from the Toluca Embassy. So it's a joke 10 people in America got, you know, when they saw the building. And in the process of rescuing her, in the gunfight with the bad guys, her skin gets ripped on her arm. And a little girl freaks out. What are you? Get away from me. Ah! So this plagues on Lindsay Wagner, who's a terrific actress. And she starts to obsess on, is she, you know, because you would really have people who get like an artificial limb have mental problems. One artificial limb, you know.
And they've established that early in the series that she had like post-traumatic stress syndrome, you know, from the accident. And she's dealt with the bionics.
They never did much with it.
Right.
So I just went full on PTSD. Right. And right after this scene, she has a scene with her boyfriend. And he's holding her hand. He says, why do you always take my left hand? What do you mean? He says, you never take my right hand. No, you know why? I know why. Because it's cold. So anyway, she has a complete mental breakdown. She goes into work and says, you know what? I'm done. I'm out of this. I'm turning in my resignation. So that was like 15 minutes into the show. So we come back in and they say, there's some people here to see you from, I had a fake NSA from the SNA or something. And they come in and they say, well, Oscar, you understand you let this girl resign? Are you aware of the secrets this woman knows, this Janie Summers has? Why, if she were kidnapped, the secret's within her own body. We cannot let her go. Now, if she wants to retire, she's, well, there's a place we can go. He says, you want to lock her in a cage, don't you? And he, this is a great performance. It's from Lindsay and from Oscar Goldman, who was, a very serious actor in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, the great Richard Anderson, man. He's a friend of the show, yep.
So now Oscar goes to her and says, I'm giving you 10 minutes warning. They're coming for you. And the whole show was the government coming after her. It was a complete paranoid, like, conspiracy theory or enemy of the people. It was, like, fantastic. So at the end, she evades all of the dragnets and all the traps and runs off over the horizon. And she's gone. So that was the ending. And Lindsay loved it,
Yeah, there's a scene at the end where they confront her. And she's squaring off against them.
Yeah.
And they said something. And I'm trying to remember the line. Was it, you're a bionic woman. I'm a woman.
Right.
And then and you have her taken off. Running bionically off into the sunset, never to be seen again.
She says that. She's gone in the blink of an eye.
Right.
So then, to my surprise, I discover a week later they're doing a reshoot, and Lindsay did the thing she said she would not do. She said, I want to end this thing. And a lot of her dialogue, her performance is so powerful because the things that she talked about being trapped in her role as a celebrity, I can't go out, nobody takes me seriously, people look at – you know what I mean? It was very analogous to – the situation you get and sort of like never getting a day off in the studio, putting you on assignments. I just put her feelings about her situation being an overworked actress for the studio in a contract. She was trapped.
Yeah. There's a great monologue she has through it where she's talking herself in the bedroom there and she smashes the bed and she smashes the mirror. Unbelievable. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Great stuff. Another producer on the show wrote that scene where she said, I changed my mind. So they can run because they run them in syndication, and after they run this episode, it could be a different episode. So
she has to be back at work at the OSI the next week.
Yeah, exactly.
Forever and ever through the 80s and 90s.
Well, that's the problem with television is until we got into the more modern era, the golden age of television now, like a Fargo and the Americans and things like this, is characters would never really change. There was no growth. There was the change. No growth, no change. T.J. Hooker is exactly the same season 3 as he was in season 2.
Right.
Even though he's, psychologically, I'm saying.
Yeah. So they have a scene with her where she comes back and she's sitting there with Richard Anderson as Oscar Goldman, and they're going over the rules, and here's how things are going to go, and I'm back to work. Yep. See you Monday morning. A lot of anniversaries this year, and I try to celebrate as many as possible right here in Comic Book Central. You know that. I'm always about the anniversaries. A big one was the 25th anniversary of Batman the Animated Series, BTAS as it's known. Now, Mark Hamill was here on the show this year. We are definitely going to get to that. Mark Hamill's coming up. But the 25th anniversary of BTAS, that also means the 25th anniversary of Harley Quinn, the Joker's best gal, Mark Hamill's best gal, and a character created specifically for the series. So 25 years of Harley Quinn. She was brought to life by the incredibly talented Arlene Sorkin. She was here, and I asked her about the character of Harley Quinn, creating her, and her influences in coming up with that voice. So there's no way you could know when you're putting together Batman the Animated Series that Harley Quinn's going to become this breakout character. Now that you've had a quarter century, I still can't believe I'm saying that. Now that you have that opportunity to kind of go back and look over the decades, what do you think contributes to the popularity of the character? How have you had a chance to assess it and just go like, why is this character so popular?
In every generation, there is a character that looks like this. In every generation, there was Vivian Blaine, there was... anyone who ever played Adelaide from Adelaide's Lament, anyone who did, Private Schwartz from, that kind of accent that Barbara Streisand did.
It's like Betty Everybody Boop. Did Betty Boop come into it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And you just have to say, in every generation, there's always an Italian talking like this, every generation. But then again, a lot of people listen to me and say, oh my God, there's so much of Harley Quinn in her.
We all know you have an incredible mind for comedy and comedic timing. You are funny. That is no doubt about that. Were you influenced by comedians when you were growing up? Like, what were you watching?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Are you kidding? I mean, comedians, I love them. And then when I was in Ireland, one of my partners did the great impression of Gracie Allen, and there was so much of her material that I thought was hilarious. And then, you know, I auditioned for Little Shop of Horrors. I really think that Ellen Green was a big part of Harley Quinn, you know, because I was such a fan of hers. But, I mean, there's no question that every generation there's somebody that does it.
All right, there you have it, kids. Harley Quinn, partly inspired by the great Gracie Allen. See the things you learn here in Comic Book Central? Say goodnight, Gracie. Hey, say happy 25th anniversary to Arlene and Harley Quinn and Batman the Animated Series. Ah, big anniversary this year. A lot of Batman the Animated Series guests over the years here on the show, by the way. So, if you're new to the show, you may not have heard those episodes, including a couple of episodes with Batman himself, Kevin Conroy. So, if you haven't heard them, check them out. They're in the archive at the website, comicbookcentral.net. All right, now Arlene's Days of Our Lives castmate. He's also Q on Star Trek The Next Generation. John DeLancey, he was here. I got to chat with him about the time that he and Arlene played hooky from Days of Our Lives to catch a sci-fi flick. She also told a story about you wanting her to sneak out of work to go see a movie. It was at a dollar theater, and I quote her, she said, because you are very economical.
Oh, God. What we did is that we went to see Alien.
That's the movie, yes. So you do remember
that's
this.
The movie.
Okay.
And it
but you should have been at work.
We should have been at work. We went to the Dome. Actually, this is a very funny story.
So it's not a dollar movie.
It's not a dollar movie.
Okay.
We went to the Dome and to see it. And we already knew that we were doing something that was very naughty. But, you know, okay. But what we didn't figure on is that it's a really long movie.
Yeah.
Okay? So in any case, we are there, and it's like 11:30 or something like that.
In the morning. Yeah, you should be at work.
In the morning. Mm-hmm. And or maybe it was even a little later than that, because we had to be back for...
She said you got back to the studio late.
Yeah. Okay. For dress rehearsal.
Yeah.
So in any case, we're watching the thing, and whatever, you know, an hour and 30 minutes in, she goes, we've got to go. I said, no. We're fine. We've got to go. We're fine. This is the best part of the movie. I'm not leaving. And she got up and she, I'm leaving. And she walked outside. But I'm thinking, she's not going anywhere. I'm the one who drove. So she'll be back. And so there are very few people in this theater right now, okay? And she does come back. And it's the first time that we see the monster full out, the head full out, okay? It's that wonderful scene. You finally go like that. Well, she has walked up behind me. And just as the monster comes out, she slams her hand down on my shoulder, except it's not me. She, in the dark, she picked the wrong guy.
It's another dude.
And he screams. Because it screams. I'm like, I'm turning around going, what's going on? And then, so that's, we in fact got to see the entire movie, and we got back sort of in time.
Yeah, not only a lot of Star Trek talk in that interview with John DeLancey, but a lot of Trek talk with several guests from that universe. But Star Trek royalty beamed into the lair when legendary Trek actress Nichelle Nichols, she stopped by for a chat, and she related a very famous story about the time she almost quit Star Trek after the first season. Okay, now after the first season, so you got through the whole first season of the show, and you're dissatisfied with your role. She's not doing a whole lot. And then you had a meeting with Martin Luther King Jr.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Okay. Can you tell us, do we have him to thank for, yes. for 50 years of Uhura, right?
Yes, that's right.
What was that conversation like? And what did he say to you to convince you to stay on?
You can't. I said, I'm leaving the show. And he simply said, you can't. And I didn't.
He convinced you about the importance of the character and the importance...
He certainly did, but he said it with two words. You can't. Do you know what you have here? You have an important role. You have an opportunity. And he said many, many things to me. The first thing he said was, you can't.
Wow.
You can't leave. Do you know how many people depend on you? You can't leave.
Well, at the time, in the television landscape, to have an African-American female character of such importance.
I was the first.
You're on the bridge. You're calling shots.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's
exactly.
Amazing.
Exactly.
That's amazing.
And I think that's what he told me.
And we are so glad that Nichelle Nichols stayed with the show. Loved her performances as Uhura. Cannot imagine the show without her. All right, from serious sci-fi to silly sci-fi. This past July, we had movie riffing week right here in my hometown, Columbus, Ohio. It was movie sign right here in Columbus. MST3K Live was here with show creator Joel Hodgson and company. I got to chat with Joel before the show, so that interview is on the same episode as the other folks from Mystery Science Theater. The next night, the Mads are back. That show made an appearance right here in Columbus, Ohio. More live movie riffing with MST3K original stars Trace Beaulieu and Frank Conniff. I got to sit down with those gents before the show at the theater, and we got to talking about Memphis, Tennessee, fried chicken, and the interesting origin of The Mads Are Back.
How did this particular tour come about?
Well, it started like almost 2 years ago now. Frank approached me. He had a gig that he was asked to do. Can I mention the venue?
Yes, you can.
This is in Memphis?
This was in Memphis.
Okay. I lived 8 years in Memphis.
Atheist Convention.
Yes.
Where was it?
The Atheist Convention.
Okay.
Easter
How
weekend.
How did you get that gig?
Atheists love me, you know. Because by the way, I'm not an atheist myself, but I'm a big fan of blasphemy, and I'm frequently blaspheming the Lord, and people
and being paid
and certain
it's called riffing the Lord.
Yes, I riff the Lord all the time, and certain aspects of our audience enjoy that, and so we did the and we're going back in August too.
Such an interesting start to this.
Well, okay, you know, that atheist convention really was a miracle.
And it was, it ended up being actually, ironically enough, a deeply spiritual experience for both Trace and myself.
So
because of the barbecue and the fried chicken that we had in Memphis.
Yes. We've joined the Church of Gus's Fried Chicken.
Oh, in Mason, Tennessee? Or did you go to the original Gus's
Memphis.
In Mason? Or did you go
in Memphis?
Okay.
And we've since have been to other ones in like Austin and around.
Because the one in Mason is the original one, about 40 minutes outside. And they, I think they leave a little bit out of the recipe in Memphis. So you tasted almost the best.
We need to go to Mecca.
Mason, Tennessee it's a great place.
Am I mixing my metaphors of religion?
No. Mecca, you can, Gus's Fried Chicken is, you just made me hungry and homesick.
But they have the hot chicken here.
They have Chili Three Ways, there's Dirty Franks. It's a foodie town.
Chili Three Ways and Dirty Franks are two porno movies that I was very disappointed in.
Welcome to Ohio, gents. Welcome to Ohio.
Never a dull moment with those guys. That was a fun conversation had there. You never know what you're going to get from them. Look, if you haven't seen them live, check the website, themadsareback.com. They're always touring the country. They're probably going to be coming to a city near you soon, so check it out. All right, it is not Comic Book Central if I'm not talking about Superman at some point. It's my favorite character. It's my favorite comic book character. Several super guests from the world of Superman were here, including the lovely and talented Dana Delaney. Now, Dana started her voiceover roles as Andrea Beaumont in Batman Mask of the Phantasm, but she is best known as the voice of none other than Lois Lane on Superman the Animated Series. We talked about her history with the character and the legacy of Lois Lane.
I did have to audition for Lois Lane, which came shortly after Mask of the Phantasm.
Right.
And I mean, that was the bigger thrill for me because I grew up reading Lois Lane comics when she had her own comic. I went to church every Sunday and got my allowance. And then after church, we would go to the drugstore and I would get my comics. You know, I'm talking about when they were 10 cents.
You bought them off the stands. Like you bought the original ones.
Yes. And
did you buy the Superman's Girlfriend Lois Lane comic?
Yes. Like I started with Superman. Uh-huh. And then I believe it was the 70s. No, what would it be? Maybe late 60s. Probably yeah. 60s, late 60s. Yeah. Yeah. And that's when the comics started going to 25 cents. Was robbery. And you know, to me, Lois Lane was my role model because she was a career girl and I wanted to be a career girl. And, you know, she was a feminist and way ahead of her time. So, and also I grew up watching the TV series, Superman, you know, with George Reeves.
Yeah. I saw this too. Like, yeah, because you had two Lois Lanes in that one as you go through. And you actually got to meet Noelle Neal at one point.
Yes. Noelle Neal, who was just lovely. And
how amazing
just
was she? Yeah. Oh,
God, great. Just great. And she loved being Lois.
She did. We saw her a couple times in Metropolis, Illinois for the Superman Festival. And she always had the Superman shirt on and, she, you know, the red, red, yellow, blue. I mean, she loved it. I think I have a statue of her there too now.
Yeah, I love that. Cool. I love that. She was a great lady. Yeah. So for me to audition for that was a bigger thrill, you know, just to get to audition. And when I read the script and Bruce and Paul and Alan, I said to them, this reads like, you know, Rosalind Russell and His Girl Friday. And they said, yeah, that's what we want. We're doing kind of that kind of throwback thing. I said, oh, okay, perfect. I know how to do that. So I just talked really fast, you know, and it worked.
Why do you think it is that the character of Lois Lane has been so beloved for, I mean, we're coming up on almost 80 years now.
I know. It's kind of amazing, isn't it?
And then you're a huge part of that history, so you get to be part of that beloved nature as well. But
I am honored to have anything to do with Lois. She's part of the oeuvre now, or the canon, I guess you would call it now, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, Superman is so American. So American, and you need to have the human there and the female there. And I love that character has survived women, you know, the ups and downs of women and their role in society. And yet that character endures. So that gives me a lot of hope.
All right, time for a few emails regarding another major Superman guest on the show this year. Major, major Superman guest. I heard from Steven Turek, who writes, my favorite episode this season is the Richard Donner one. His Superman movie is still my favorite superhero film. Thanks for all the wonderful work you do. Hey, thanks to you for listening, Steven. I appreciate you writing in. And I'm quite partial to Donner's Superman flick as well. It's definitely one I like. I also heard from Doug Meacham. Doug writes, behold the Stuberman. Congratulations on 4 years of Comic Book Central. I'd have to say my most favorite episode this year was your interview with the great Richard Donner. I never tire of listening to him recount his days of working on the Superman movies. I hope to one day meet him at a convention like I met Ilya Salkind in Los Angeles 5 years ago and thank him for contributing to one of pop culture's most iconic films. It was this film that introduced me to Superman at such a young age, and I have been a fan ever since. I also want to say again how much of a pleasure it was to meet you at Terrificon this year. I only went the one day but got out of it all that I possibly could. I will definitely try to attend the whole convention next year. I'm anxiously curious to see who you have lined up as guests for year 5 of your show, and I can't wait to listen. Good luck, sir, and up, up, and away. Hey, thanks for writing in, Doug. Yeah, so glad we got to meet up at Terrificon. That was fun. Love meeting up with the listeners. If you're at a convention, you know I'm going to be there. Tap me on the shoulder, say hey. Always love chatting with you listeners out there. Like I said, epic year here on the show. Look, you longtime listeners know that 1978's Superman the movie, it is my all-time favorite superhero flick. It is the gold standard. It is the one by which all others are judged. And I have welcomed so many talents from that movie here to Comic Book Central over the years. Again, if you haven't heard them, go check them out there in the archive. But since day one, I have wanted to have a sit-down conversation with the man who directed the film. The man who demanded verisimilitude, that reality and storytelling. The man who made us believe a man could fly. Director Richard Donner. It finally happened this year. I've been trying since the beginning, I'm telling you. We covered a lot of ground, though, in that interview. From his early work on The Twilight Zone with William Shatner. That was cool. up through the latest information on Goonies 2. We chat a little bit about that. But you know, this was all about the big blue Boy Scout, the Man of Steel, Superman. That's what we're talking about. Got a chance to play a little bit of free association with him about his cast on the film. And of course, we talked about the main man himself, Christopher Reeve. Christopher Reeve.
Good old Chris. He was born to play Superman. Superman was created in the mid-30s in anticipation of Chris Reeve coming along in life. And that's all I got to say about him, except very special, wonderful individual I love dearly. And we were blessed to have him.
Look, there are a lot of superhero movies and TV shows today. So many of them out there. He mentioned during that interview that Jeff Johns at DC had asked him about directing. But Mr. Donner assured me that, he told me during the interview to call him Dick. So Dick assured me that he was enjoying his retirement. He's not planning on coming out of retirement. But surprisingly, during that interview, I think I may have stumbled onto the superhero movie that would get him back into the director's chair. When are you going to direct some of this stuff?
Oh, I've done it. I've had it.
When are you going to direct some of this stuff?
I sleep until 8:30 or 9 o'clock, and then I go and take a nap. And I love it. And my whole life, all I did was get up at 5 in the morning, get ready for the set, come home at 9, 10 at night, work Saturdays, and then Sundays go to the editing room. And I've had it. I just love my life. I love my wife. And I don't think there's any way possible I would ever go back. I've done it. King of the Bed.
Even if there was a fan outpouring of emotion where we just wanted you to come back, maybe even direct an episode of Supergirl. They're bringing Miss Teschmacher into Supergirl, and they've got all your Fortress of Solitude looking stuff there. They've referenced the earthquake in California.
At one point Jeff mentioned maybe, and I said no, and he said right.
Oh, so Jeff did ask you about that.
Yes.
And you said no.
No, I don't. I had a great career. I love it. I help out a lot in the office here with some of the younger producers, and I'm the old sage is here to speak, and they go out and do just the opposite. And it's nice hanging around. And but no, I don't wear those shoes that I can get wet anymore.
Fair enough. I had to ask the question. Just to close it out, next year Superman celebrates his 80th anniversary. Your film, your epic film, celebrates its 40th anniversary. I can't believe it's been this long. Why do you believe the character Superman has lasted so long, and why is your film still considered the gold standard?
You know, it's simple. It's simple and it's corny, but it's nothing more than truth, justice, and the American way. It's the American way. It's as long as they get a little bit back to the American way, and this is a symbol of our country. It's to me, Lex Luthor is in the White House. And truth, justice, and the American way is going to get him out.
So that means you're going to come back and direct then, right?
If I could do that one, I would.
That would be the script that would bring you back. I think we have stumbled onto something here, folks. I think we found out how to get Richard Donner back into directing superheroes. All right, I tried, folks. I tried. I tried to get him into the director's chair again. Well, who knows? Maybe that little conversation there inspired him for Lethal Weapon 5. I've just read that he's in talks for it. I don't know if it's true or not, but look, hopefully we inspired him to get back to directing. That'd be very cool. All right, theme shows. You know I love them. I'm doing them all the time. Last couple of Februarys, I brought you Flashback, Flash Forward February, talking about guests from the world of The Flash. Always looking at theme shows. Well, with episodes 169 through 174, we got Lost in Space all over again. I started with author Mark Cushman, who wrote a 3-volume set setting forth just about every Lost in Space fact you can imagine. Those books are incredible. Get them if you don't have them already. But then Lost in Space cast members, Bill Mumy, Angela Cartwright, Mark Goddard, Marta Kristen, they were all here all in a row. Man, and then I wrapped up my look back at Lost in Space with a look forward to Lost in Space. Producer Kevin Burns, he joined me in the lair to chat about the new Lost in Space series that's headed to Netflix very soon. So if you're a fan of Lost in Space, you want to know where the franchise is headed next, if you haven't heard any of those episodes, go give them a listen. You're going to love them. The freaky swinging 60s on up to the new Netflix stuff. We're talking about everything. What I loved was chatting with comic book fanboy Bill Mumy, and he is truly a fanboy. If you follow Bill online, you've probably seen a picture of him from back in the day having dinner with some very famous friends and a few legendary talents from the world of comic books. I got to hear about this dinner. There's this picture.
Oh, man, unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Okay, it's you. Tell everyone who's in the picture.
Photograph, which was taken at my house in 1987 at a dinner party that my wife Eileen and I hosted, there is a photograph that is out on the internet for years now, and it is a picture of my late partner and writing partner and friend Miguel Ferrer, my buddy Mark Hamill, Mr. Luke Skywalker, and there are three gentlemen with us, and they happen to be Jerry Siegel, Bob Kane, and Jack Kirby.
Right?
I got to tell you, playing with Ringo was pretty cool, but that dinner was like up there.
Yeah.
So here's the deal. The late, great Julie Schwartz, editor at DC Comics from 1942 on, right?
Right.
Julie Schwartz. I had met Julie at a comic book convention that I, because of all these Lost in Space, Twilight Zone stuff, I've been going to sci-fi and comic book conventions since they were in existence. So I'd met Julie. Julie was a fan of actors. And whenever Julie came to Los Angeles, he would invite me to lunch, and it would be with one of these iconic comic book golden age greats, whether it was Jack Kirby, whether it was Bob Kane, whether it was Jerry Siegel, whether it was Gil Kane, on and on and on. I met all these people. Had lunch with them, heard their stories, exchanged some pleasantries, and I was always grateful to Julie for opening those doors because I was a huge fan of these guys, right? I mean, come on, Jerry Siegel created Superman. Jerry Siegel created the Spectre.
Bob Kane Batman,
created Batman. And Bob,
Jack Kirby, everything else with Stan Lee.
Right. Yeah. Everything.
They created
else.
Our and, childhood, yeah.
And nobody had forget about everybody's catalog, but nobody had a bigger impact than Jack as in comic books to me, because his art leaps off the covers and it's so dynamic and it's so energetic that whenever I would see a Kirby comic book at the age of, 8, 9, 10, et cetera, onwards, they would be the first ones I would gravitate to. Mm-hmm. They would be the ones that I wanted to read the first. And honestly, without trying to disrespect anybody, if there was a Kirby cover and I opened it up and it was a Don Heck interior or something, I'd be like, oh. Oh.
There was a little bit of a letdown from the cover.
Not that there was anything wrong with Don Heck, but, if the difference between a Kirby-drawn story, like an early Fantastic Four.
Yeah, full-blown adventure, yeah.
Exactly. Thor, whatever, and someone else, it was never as dynamic and as impressive as Jack's
The
work,
splash
so.
Pages, double splash pages. I mean, it was just insane stuff. Even today, the Thor trailer, artwork is like they're it's Kirby artwork that's in there.
Yeah, that looks great. Hella looks great. I'm looking forward to that.
Go ahead. I nerded out there for a second.
I know him from work.
I know, yes.
That cracked me up. I know this guy from work. I'm sorry, I'm babbling on.
No, I'm doing the same thing. I'm sorry, I nerded out on
it. I had met these people individually, and I had had nice exchanges with them. Jerry Siegel couldn't have been a more gentle, soft-spoken, wonderful, sweet, sweet man. And he loved the Twilight Zones, loved them. Hmm. He was very complimentary about my work as a child. Jack... you know, I was writing comic books for Marvel when I first met Jack, and he was so just helpful and enthusiastic and wanted to discuss plot lines with me. And yes, he truly, honestly did tell war stories and things. And it was just, and Roz was, his wife Roz was just so wonderful. Bob was like a hoot. Bob was like the, like a character from Dobie Gillis. He was just, his ego was beyond belief, and it was almost like a cartoon, and you had to love the guy because he was just so full of himself, and yet at the same time, you know, you look at those early detective stories and his artwork from the original, you know, year on the character in the books, and you go, wow, that guy really had style, man. Mm-hmm. You know, he really did create that look, and it's fantastic. So anyway, I'd met them all, and I said to my wife, Eileen, I said, you know, I don't think they've hung out together since the 40s. Why don't we have them to dinner? And she said, okay. She's great. My wife is great. We've been married over 30 years. Anyway, all it took were 3 phone calls. That's it.
And they're all in.
Hi, Jack. Hi, Roz. It's Bill Mumy. Oh, hi. We'd like to have a dinner party and invite, you know, you guys and the Kirbys and maybe Bob Kane and his wife. Oh, that sounds great. Haven't seen, that would be wonderful. Okay, great. How's this date? Date, that's great. Then that was it. 3 phone calls.
Yeah, and
then
sure
they all said yes.
I'm sure you didn't have to twist Mark and Miguel's arm either. You guys were all comic book nerds.
Mark, Miguel, and I were all passionate Golden Age collectors. Yeah. And, you know, Mark and Miguel and I had been at a lot of these lunches with Julie. So it was just a wonderful night. It was a magical night.
All right. He mentioned him in that chat right there. Bill's friend, Mark Hamill. He loves him some comic books as well. He was at that dinner with those legendary comic book folks. He was right here on Comic Book Central as well. It was back in February. It was part of my month-long salute to The Flash. Flashback, flash forward February. Mark was part of both of those worlds. Flashback, he was 90s Trickster. Flash forward, he's today's Trickster. And in that interview, it was really in-depth. We talked about everything. His quest to collect pop culture stuff, to showcase the pop culture stuff of other people in his new series. We talked about the Joker. We talked about the Trickster. We talked about that galaxy far, far away. It was one of my favorite episodes. And from your emails, a lot of you out there liked it as well. I heard from Scott Doran, winner of last year's anniversary giveaway. Scott wrote in and he said, hey, Joe, happy anniversary to Comic Book Central. This will mark 1 year for me to listen to this podcast. I just want to say you have great guests and I've enjoyed them all. I thought it through and through. My favorite for this past year was The Trickster, Joker, Gargoyle, Hobgoblin, and Jedi Knight / Jedi Master Luke Skywalker, Mark Hamill. It's nice to hear a fellow geek pursue his dream and be part of pop culture and still embrace it. As I said, it's good to hear from a fan of the geek community. Again, happy anniversary, Comic Book Central. Here's to 4 more and beyond. Hey, thanks, Scott. So glad you're joining us in the lair each week. Thanks for writing in. He's played a lot of characters, and we talked about a bunch of them. John Folk also wrote in. He says, just wanted to let you know how much I've enjoyed Comic Book Central. There are many great moments this last season. My favorite moment was winning Arrow on Blu-ray. Well, there you go. That would be a pretty cool moment. Second was definitely the Mark Hamill interview. Cannot wait to see what the new year has in store. Hey, thanks, John. Glad to hear you're enjoying the Blu-ray set. It's a good one. I think that's the one where Katrina Law appeared on first. So I think there's even a feature on there as well. So yeah, it's a pretty cool Blu-ray set. Pretty great season of Arrow. Evan Kendall also wrote in and says, happy anniversary, Joe. Another great year for Comic Book Central. As I went through the episodes to pick a favorite moment, the decision became harder and harder. There were so many. Burt Ward caught my eye. His stories were great, and I was fascinated by his work with shelter dogs. But my all-time favorite this year was Mark Hamill. That was this year's How Did You Get Him moment, and it was a great interview. He is really one of us who gets to have fun making the pop culture that we all love. Thanks for the great podcast. I'm looking forward to another great year of Comic Book Central. Well, thank you for writing in as well. Look, you asked about how did I get him on the show. Patience, perseverance, persistence, all those things. That's what I say when it comes to booking guests. Richard Donner, Mark Hamill, Burt Ward, obviously since day one, but one, all those guys here. So been working those phones since started the show. you know, paid off this year. That's all I can say. Just got to keep at it. Next up, Jose De Leon. He says, my favorite episode was with Mark Hamill. I like when he gives his opinion about the other actors who've been the Joker and how he can appreciate something different about what each of them brings to the table with their take. Also, it was funny when he mentioned being cast as the trickster and flying around with the boots on or walking in the sky, comparing it to being Luke Skywalker. That was a great one. Hey, thanks so much for writing in, Jose. Yeah, a lot of great trickster knowledge from Mark Hamill in that interview. Look, he goes deep with his comic book knowledge. We know that. In fact, let's get to some of the best moments from that interview. You guys all wanted to hear some more from it. We're going to revisit it. First, I asked Mark about his early influences, especially as it pertains to voice acting.
Well, I mean, I was a mimic. I liked to imitate actors' voices. I was especially enamored of all the Universal horror films, so I was, you know, trying out my Boris Karloff and trying to figure out where did he get that accent. And you'd read about it. And the days before the internet, you had to actually go to the library. And you go, oh, he was born in England. William Henry Pratt. Okay. Bela Lugosi. Who in the world talks like this? I don't know. You know, I said, where does this guy come from? My dad would say, he's Dracula. He comes from Dracula land. But, you know, I mean, obviously he was from Hungary. So I was then Peter Lorre, all of them. In fact, I've also often credited Claude Rains in The Invisible Man as part of the inspiration for my Joker voice, even though I didn't consciously at the time say I'm going to do Claude Rains. That Invisible Man speech that I remembered from, you know, when I was 8 years old, crazy, you think I'm crazy, I'll show you who's crazy. That grit and that sort of menace was a starting point anyway.
Of course, we talked about Star Wars. You got to talk about Star Wars. We hit on a lot. Rogue One, talked about Rogue One. The new Star Wars films with younger actors, replacing those characters with younger actors. We talked about that. And in this clip coming up, the famous lunch with George Lucas and Carrie Fisher and the 40th anniversary of Star Wars. Look, if I told 26-year-old Mark Hamill, if 40 years from now, this movie would be bigger than ever and that he would be starring in the latest entry in the series, what would he have said?
I would have said, arrest this man. He's obviously disturbed. Listen, I thought, you know, of course, again, we're going back to the early days of, you know, VHS and home video and all that. I thought, you know, 4 or 5 years after the last one came out, it would sort of, you know, it would always have a presence of some sort, but never the longevity that it's had. And partly the reason was that George told us at some point, look, after the prequels, after episodes 1, 2, and 3, that's it. I'm not doing 7, 8, 9 because I don't want to be doing these things in my 70s, which I totally understood. And also, too, I never thought that if they did a third trilogy that we would be involved. I just figured it would be all new characters, and it didn't occur to me that that I would be involved. I mean, obviously, George said, I'm not doing them, you know? I mean, then there was the famous meeting in the summer of 2012. We knew something was up because he asked Mary Lou, my wife, and I to come to lunch with Carrie, but he asked that my daughter go to lunch with George's daughter. In other words, they didn't want anybody else in the room. So
okay, so you knew something was up, something more than just hey, can you go do the latest version or walk a red carpet?
Well, I thought, you know, what it usually is, you know, the movie's coming out on Blu-ray. We want to do a new
documentary. Yeah, my 18th version of it. Yeah,
exactly. And so, I mean, I'm always sort of. I want to aid George any way I can, but I was sort of cynical about it. I said, oh, well, they're releasing the movies in 3D. You watch. He's going to ask us to do some kind of promotional material. And Mary Lou said, what if he wants to do a new trilogy? And I just laughed.
She knew. She knew.
I just thought, you know, I said, he told us he's not doing that. So
yeah, she knew.
When he actually said what he said, which was, well, you know, I've decided to turn over the company to Kathy Kennedy, and they want to do a new trilogy, and if you don't want to do it, we we'll write your character out. We won't recast.
Oh, like he would have done that. Like he would have done that.
Well, I kept a poker face, yeah. I have to tell you, Joe. I mean, inside, I was just absolutely stunned.
Stunned in what way, though? Stunned good or stunned, oh, no?
Well, probably a little of both, because, I mean, you know, there's a part of you that wants to rise to any challenge, and then there's the other part that thinks, well, wait a second, we had a beginning, a middle, and an end. I was sort of thinking, I don't know, it's kind of dangerous to bring it back. And, you know, the fans can be so hypercritical. I mean, right. There's a difference between not liking a movie and saying it ruined your childhood. So I know how caustic some of the critics can be. So I thought, well, I don't know. I mean, within 30 seconds of George saying that we want you back, Carrie Fisher went, I'm in! And even said, is there anything for Billy in it? And later, of course, Billy was in the movie. But
yeah.
I said, Carrie, poker face. Yeah, poker face. You don't just immediately scream out, I'm
in.
You
have to negotiate.
Exactly. But she was, you know, I mean, obviously she was very smart and said, well, look, you know, what roles are there for women in their 50s? Mm-hmm. You know, this is a blessing in disguise.
Yeah.
And
she is so missed. She is so missed.
But I can't even process it. I mean, she's so present tense in my mind.
Yeah. My wife and I just said that the other day. It's like, I keep thinking she's going to show up on a talk show with Gary.
Yeah.
And just be her. It was, we saw her one woman show and it was just like the funniest night of our lives. Anyway.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Obviously, you know, you have her to look forward to in episode 8, but it's cast this terrible melancholy over the experience because it was so untimely.
Yeah, untimely is right, man. Carrie is so missed. But we are just a short time away from seeing her again on the big screen with Mark Hamill in The Last Jedi. Cannot wait to see that film. It's going to be amazing. With Mark Hamill, you know, Star Wars, he's returned to that universe, but that wasn't the only universe to which he returned. He also returned to the world of The Flash as the Trickster. Bigger surprise for you, returning as Luke Skywalker or the Trickster?
Wow. Both of them. I mean, and Wing Commander too. I have this whole theme of coming back to franchises I hadn't thought about in years. I mean, when I watched The Flash from the very first episode, because I knew John Wesley Shipp was playing Barry's father, and I'm very fond of John, and I think he's a terrific actor. And I thought it was so clever. I said, boy, you know, they have it all over the original Flash series in the sense that they use that storyline where the father's falsely convicted of the mother's murder. So, I mean, there's that thread, you know, that runs through all the episodes.
So you were watching the show then? You were watching?
I was watching the show, exactly.
Okay.
And I would watch it with my daughter, Chelsea. And she loved it. I like it too. Then I hear, you know, through my agent, they want you to return The Flash. So I'm thinking, well, I'm a contemporary of John's, and so I'll probably play the prison warden. I could play a cellmate. I could play his lawyer. I could play the prison priest. Who knows? Who do they want me to play? When they said the Trickster, I said, are they out of their minds? I mean, it was dodgy rocking that one-piece leotard, you know, 20 years ago, much less the idea. I said, you know, you guys, it just sounds a little bit wrong, age inappropriate. They said, well, come meet with us. Well, we want to tell you our ideas for the Trickster. So, you know, I was happy to hear their ideas and, you know, what they came up with. I mean, it was so smart. I mean, they had a Devon Gray playing a younger Trickster wannabe, and I was sort of this Hannibal Lecter type figure who is
creepy,
incarcerated. Yeah, but really sort of asked to help bring down this new Trickster. You know, I just thought it was so smart and so well done. So I was happy to go back.
You've often said that Star Wars fans know more about the Star Wars movies and the Star Wars Expanded Universe at this point than you do. That's right. Not the case with these comic book projects, though, is it?
You know
a little bit.
I mean, I'm sort of more someone that's stuck in the era of comics when I read them. So I'm more sort of Silver Age, and I branched out into Golden Age, and I'm not so on top of the new product that's coming out.
But for the 1990 version, you knew the Trickster.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. In fact, I said, am I going to have those air shoes where I get to run through the sky? Because I thought, that's the pun, right? He's the original Skywalker. But so far, they haven't, done that. You know, I keep thinking, because I got to do... I did a team up with Wentworth Miller and with Liam McIntyre. Oh. And Liam gets to fly. I said, I'm so jealous. I mean, Weather Wizard gets to fly.
Yeah.
I said, you'd think that Trickster would come up with some kind of contraption or some sort of gimmick. I always saw him. I said, let's play him almost like Wile E. Coyote, where he comes up with these elaborate Rube Goldberg type over elaborate gimmicks. And,
just short of Acme being written on them.
Exactly, smashing into the mountainside. I just said that's sort of a fun undercurrent we can play with. And
but you did that in the 1990 version, though, didn't you? Like that was a Looney Tunes cartoon come to life, especially the second one.
Oh, absolutely, especially the second one.
Sound effects and yeah.
Yeah, well, originally they didn't want to do any costumed villains. They were trying to keep it very sort of dark, and they were very much influenced by the Tim Burton Batman films of the time. And the Trickster was the first time they did a costume villain. It was mid-season. I think I was episode 13. And for Danny Bilson and Paul DeMeo, who were the head honchos back then, they said, we really missed a trick here. I mean, no pun intended, but in the sense that they thought they could get away with having just evil scientists or motorcycle gangs or drug runners as the villains. But as we all as comic book fans know, you've got to have an over-the-top villain to match the hero. Batman has his Joker, Superman has Lex Luthor, and aside from the Batman's rogues gallery, the Flash probably has the best villains out there. Like I say, it's been so satisfying for me to be able to revisit these characters I love, and the support of the fan world is, it's beyond what I expected, and I think it's because they know I'm one of them. I'm not a poser. I'm a fan just like them.
Now, he is definitely a fanboy, and we're all fanboys. We're Mark Hamill fans. We are looking forward, like I said, to The Last Jedi. That is just around the corner. And in the world of The Flash, man, I can't imagine we're not going to be seeing Mark again as the Trickster. Got to have those annual appearances, right? Look, they just brought Elongated Man onto the show. How cool would it be? Trickster versus Elongated Man? That would be an epic episode. Would love to see that one. All right, time to give away some stuff. I have got Arrow Season 3 on Blu-ray, courtesy of the fine folks at Warner Brothers, and I am sending that Blu-ray set out to Doug Meacham and the Mark Hamill Trickster exclusive one-of-a-kind sketch cover, courtesy of the amazingly talented Lynn Workman. That goes out to Jeff Messer. Congrats, gents. Thank you both for writing in. Thank everybody for writing in, telling me your favorite moments. Love when you do that. Helps me put the show together. Both of you guys, Doug Meacham, Jeff Messer, get your addresses to me. joe@comicbookcentral.net. Get those to me, and I'm going to be sending out those super cool giveaways to you. Again, congratulations, and thanks so much for writing in. Folks, if you missed any of the episodes that we talked about today, or any of the 199 shows that are out there, there's a bunch out there. They're all in the archive. They're at the website. Have at them. comicbookcentral.net. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. I highly recommend it. Then you just get them all automatically. If you're in iTunes, leave a review. If you look, it's Mark Hamill, it's Richard Donner, it's Burt Ward. Go give this thing 5 stars on iTunes. It takes you 2 seconds to do that. It's free. Oh, those guys were worth five stars. Nichelle Nichols, oh, Dana Delaney, man, it's all five-star stuff. Get those episodes, binge listen, especially if you're going to be doing some traveling in the next few months, man. Take Comic Book Central on the road with you, and be sure to share the lair. Give us a like on Facebook. It's facebook.com/comicbookcentralnetwork. Make sure you include the network, get the right one. Twitter at comicbookctrl. Share it on Facebook and Twitter. Share those posts. Hashtag share the lair. Retweet when I post the episodes each week. You can also check out the show on Stitcher, Blueberry, Google Play, on all those services. And be sure to reach out to me. Drop me a line. You can click that Signal Me tab on the website or send an email, joe@comicbookcentral.net. Or you can record a voicemail at the website. I want to hear from you. And with that, I will close out year four of Comic Book Central. Oh, that was a fantastic year. I'm so glad you were all a part of it. Thanks to all of my guests, everyone who appeared on the show. And thanks to each and every one of you out there for listening to the show, for sharing the show. You are Comic Book Central Nation, and I am so grateful to each and every one of you for hanging out in the lair each and every week with me. We have the mostest fun, don't we? This is the coolest place to be. Oh, man. Yeah, it is. Thanks so much for listening, too. I'm going to take a little bit of a break. Man, it's been a long year. I'm going to take a little bit of a break from bringing you the show. I'm going to take a few weeks off. But I'm still going to be working behind the scenes. Some big changes on the way for year five, I'm telling you now. It's primarily with some of the methods of offering the show, getting it out there to a wider audience on a bigger platform. I'm looking at something right now. You're going to be hearing more about that in the next few weeks. Looking to make a few changes on the website as well, too. So a lot going on behind the scenes here. I'm going to be working on that for the next few weeks. I'm going to be booking guests, getting ready for year five, getting ready to launch that new season. So keep an eye on the Facebook page. Keep an eye on the Twitter feed. Make sure you're following on social media. I'm going to be making some big announcements there soon. Until next time, keep sharing the lair. Keep reading those comics. Thanks for joining me here in the lair. Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations, 3.0 imported license. All other content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of their respective holders.
You're fun.
Did Han shoot first?
Of course! I don't understand. Listen, George owns these movies. He can do what he likes with them. But it seems to me they should preserve the originals just from the standpoint of film history. And yet the originals have been sort of disappeared for the special editions. And I'm sort of torn because I thought, well, it's his to do with as he likes. But for the purists, they want to see what they saw when they were a little kid. And the whole idea of changing the idea of who shot first, because I thought that pretty much defines Solo's character, that he would be somebody not only to shoot first, but shoot under the table. It's like the exact opposite of like a noble protagonist type, and that's what we liked about Han Solo. He was unpredictable. He was, you know, he blurred the edges between hero and scoundrel. So, but I am sort of old school. They also said, you know, will you stop commenting on the holiday special? And I said, look, you guys, the reason I like the holiday special, I mean, I've never seen the whole thing. I've seen clips over the years. But I, at the time, said, this is a terrible mistake. We shouldn't do this. If we do it, it should be written like a Bob Hope special or something. And that's the problem. It's a mashup with two genres that don't work together. But it shows we're human. It shows we make mistakes. It shows that, you know, we're not infallible. And I said to them, I said, you should embrace it. You should put the holiday special as one of the extras. When they were having us do the documentaries for the movies coming out on DVD, I said, that was my suggestion. And, of course, you know, they didn't listen to me.
I love Carrie Fisher singing any chance I can hear it.
Yeah. I listen. We celebrate a day of peace, of perfect harmony. She was a great singer. Now, I said to George at the time, because I said, I don't want to do this. And he said, oh, come on, we got to do this. You know, people forget, that came out the Christmas of
78.
And the movie had been in the theaters for nearly 18 months, which was unheard of at the time. So he said, do it as a favor to me. It's mostly to keep a presence in people's minds and help with the merchandising and blah, blah, blah. And I said, okay, I'll do it for you, George. But I said, but I'm not singing. And he goes, well, you don't like to sing? I said, I love singing. Mark loves singing. But I don't think it's right for Luke. So they, at the very least, they took me out of the I didn't have to do a song. But it worked for Carrie, not number one, because she's the princess, and number two, she had a great voice.
I still have my original TV Guide ad and my bootleg version on DVD.